Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with the Sunday Times Magazine. Thought-provoking, visually arresting, and oh so entertaining. Guard your copy fiercely.
Hello there. Well, my two guests this morning are Dubliners and longtime friends. If they'd listened to their fathers, one would now be an eminent barrister. The other would have recently retired from a respectable job in an office. But they didn't listen to their fathers. Instead, they pursued their interests in words and music at home and abroad, and they've collaborated together over the years. Micheál O'Shiel's most recent collection of poems, Tongues, has just been published by Blood Axe Books, while Saoirse Bodley's contribution to music in Ireland is marked by a new field day book simply called Saoirse Bodley. You're both very welcome here this morning.
Thank you very much.
You're both Dubliners, of course.
Yes, indeed, we are. We are both Dubliners from different parts of Dublin, I suppose, but both born between the canals, which makes us essential Dubliners.
I'm afraid I only just barely got in between the canals. I was in from my birth, but I'm afraid I was brought up outside. In fact, I was brought up in this area. I played where RTE now is and climbed trees in Montrose before it was ever RTE, and climbed them with Rory Quinn, who was later to be Minister of Finance and leader of the Labour Party. And so we climbed trees here together.
So who is the better tree climber, you or Rory?
Of course I was.
Of course.
But of course I failed afterwards. He really climbed the tree.
No. How did you first meet both of you?
Well,
you
we first met at a, I think it was a small reception in Cecil the Painter's.
Cecil King. Yeah. Cecil King the Painter. I recall it very well because you were hurrying off to a concert hall afterwards.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. That's right. We were there just for a short time, my first wife and myself. You know, that was the beginning of it. But we met then also later when we both became among the first members of Eas Thonna.
But the fact that you met at the Painter, in other words, you both were interested, very interested in painting and the arts and culture from a young age.
That's right. Yeah.
But Cecil King also and his partner Oliver Dowling were tremendous hosts. I mean, Cecil was a great man. Irish stew is what he used to make for his guests. And Oliver, who ran the gallery at the time, they were wonderful hosts. So you met all sorts of exciting people there. You know, so it was a place where you met others. But I've always admired Saoirse's work because I love the way he manages to get both sort of traditional music through. He also manages to do that with a very modernistic approach. But you see, I basically think that he's a poet monkey. He really wants to be a poet, and I probably in my heart loved music as well. So we're sort of, was an actual friendship that way, I think.
That's interesting though, but when you were a little boy, where did you grow up, Saoirse?
I grew up in Phibbsborough. But in those days, it was Phibbsborough as a very different place from now because the building stopped, certainly beyond Glasnevin Graveyard, you know, where now there is an extended Finglas and so on. That didn't exist then. And there was a little river there, I remember well, just a little bit further out, just beyond the old Finglas. And the river ran through a gully and there were lovely trees around it. And a friend of mine used to walk there and play there. You know.
Happy childhood?
Yes, by and large, yes. There were things I didn't like so much about it. But
like what?
Like school, for instance, which I found rather brutal, you know.
Did you?
Yes, yeah. Well, it was in the days when slapping and all that was common.
Did you get slapped?
Oh, yeah, sure, everybody did, you know.
And did you like music in school?
I did, but there wasn't very much done there. Now, I did become, through their offices, I'd say probably one of the worst fiddle players that ever existed. but I did at least learn to finger the instrument, which is very useful, you know.
And had there been music in your home?
Well, there was music in my home, like my father, but it wasn't professional music or anything like that, or even specifically classical music. My mother played the piano and my father played the mandolin. He played the mandolin in the mandolin band. And I learnt the mandolin myself from him. And now I'm just a retired mandolin player whose tremolo is gone.
He's also the emeritus professor of music at UCD, by the way. Micheál, where did you grow up?
Well, as I said, I grew up here near Donnybrook, in fact, you know, and went to school here. I was actually at St. Michael's, just down the road from here. I was palling around. I palled around a lot with Rory Quinn as a boy, and then for some reason or other, we sort of drifted a bit, and I was palling around with another chap whose brother had been at Clongowes, and he was being sent away, and it's almost as if I had to join the minority, because it was very frowned on if you went off to Clongowes. I mean, from the Holy Ghost Fathers to move to the Jesuits was considered not the thing to do, but I begged my parents to send me off to school, because I had some dream, some Billy Bunter dream, I think, of quads and cads and that sort of thing, and so I ended up at Clongowes at 12.
And did it live up to your dreams? Did you like it?
Initially, yes. I mean, can you think of anything more exciting? I mean, I wrote a whole series of poems about it afterwards. I mean, there's a sadness to it, because I left home and I never returned in many ways. I mean, you went back for holidays, but I was uneasy. I wanted to get back to school. That's where my friends were. I was brought up by my friends. At first, yes, I loved it. I mean, people love sleepovers. Children love sleepovers, for instance. To get up every morning and to go for a walk with your friends and have breakfast with your friends, you know, and to be at night rec, to be with them and so on, to be with your friends all the time. It was wonderful.
And yet that poem, one of the poems you wrote about it, was Visit, wasn't it? And it's kind of sad. I think it's still read. It certainly was read a lot to first years at Clongowes about leaving home and the loneliness.
Yes, I believe it was for a while. It was given as a warning to parents, I think, for this not to happen. But it was no reflection of my own parents. I mean, gosh, they were put to the pin of their collar to pay very expensive fees at the time. But just you drifted apart. That's what's in that poem, Visit, is you drifted apart. Your world became who got on the team, who got picked for this, and, you know, who was in trouble with one of the masters. And your friends rallied around you. That became your world.
Can you say a few lines from Visit?
I'm sure I can, yes. I'd love to do that. It's family doings, bulletins from a neighbourhood, mention of names, small emissaries of emotion from suburban roads, old gravities draw me for a moment homeward, and I resist. We are visitors for each other. Unwittingly, those weeks of initiation leave a baffle between us. Our words fall short. I'm learning a new language, another lore.
It's beautiful.
Yes, it's lovely. It's lovely.
And Saoirse, your father wanted you to get a sensible job in an office.
Yes.
You? At what stage did you realise you would like to try and pursue a career in music?
It was really started more from an interest in the arts, which I developed quite early. Yeah, I was interested in painting, and I was interested in theatre. And I mean, if you live in Phibbsborough, one thing about it is you're very close in, you know. And I can remember the first time I saw a play that really, it was the first proper play, was Shakespeare's Twelfth Night in the Gate Theatre. And it was with Aidan Grinnell and Iris Lawler, if you might know their names. And it was a very good performance, and I was fascinated by this. But my mother had actually walked with me from the house down to the Gate Theatre, you know. We walked there. It was within walking distance.
And you loved the local library as well, didn't you?
The one thing my father introduced me to was the local library, and he also was insistent, and he was quite right, that I don't just take out the two fiction books, but that I'd also take out the three non-fiction that you were allowed to take out at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
And it was right in that. So I read fairly widely on different things. When I went to an acting school, I started to read Stanislavski on theatre, you know.
And Micheál, when you were a little boy, you had a certain amount of difficulty. Did you get a type of polio when you were a young boy?
I was very lucky. I came out of it fairly easily, but I had full-blown polio when I was in 1956. It was there was it was quite a wave of it in Ireland in 1956, largely in Cork
in
and
Cork,
Wexford.
Yes, I remember that.
And I was in Wexford on holidays and picked it up. So I was three or 4 months out of commission, with my parents having to stay up all night keeping guard over me, because if I moved, apparently I'd be in danger of paralysing things and so forth. It was quite a but one that had a huge effect on my life, I think, really, because I think to be alone as a child and having to recover and so on marks you for life. It marks you with this sense of both valuing life with and enjoying life, but also a sense of wistfulness, I think, as well. And I think those two things combined, that nothing else would make me happy but to try and express that for the rest of my life. And that's been my life in poetry. And it fitted in with school. At the primary school, I actually cut as a boy out of the primary school, out of the senior book, Poets and Poetry for Irish Schools. I cut out two little pages, which became...
And you have them in your hand.
I have them in my hand here. They shaped my life. Rather lugubrious, the sort of the taste the anthologist had, but my gosh, I mean...
Give me a flavour of
just, well, Crossing the Bar by Tennyson, an extraordinary thing. Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea. I mean, gosh, the magic of that. After that, I thought nothing in life ever could measure up to the excitement of that. What it moved me. It made me want to laugh. It made me want to cry. It just brought up all those emotions. But it also made sense. There's an intellectual element to it as well. And it's beautiful. I mean, the moaning of the bar. The bar is, of course, for those who sail, they'll know, the bar is the bar of sand that which you go over when you go out of the harbour. But it's also, of course, the end of life and so on. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. And just those, the shorter line, the longer line, and those rhymes and so what they do to you, my God.
Maybe it's because of the polio. You were obviously quite a serious little boy, because if you had those pages from primary school, there aren't an awful lot of maybe 10, 11, 12-year-old boys who might be like that.
You're probably marked a little bit, I think, by being on your own. But I mean, the great tragedy after polio for me wasn't I wasn't allowed to play on the under-10s rugby team. I had been on the under-9s and had to wait for the under-11s again, and it broke my heart. So I was serious, but I also was an all-rounder. I played sport. I did everything that was to be had at school, you know. But obviously, this had got into me and it never left me. I'm still at it.
And when you were young, your mum was often ill as well, wasn't she, Micheál?
Most of my life, my mother was ill. She died at 56. It's a strange thing to have passed the age of your own mother. It's a very strange feeling. But she'd had, I think, some sort of fever as a child. It had damaged her heart. And in those days, of course, rather than send you walking for your heart, you took to the bed, as it was called.
Which is probably the worst thing you could.
Probably the worst thing you could possibly do. But I'm not sure even now what she had. I forget the actual technical name that they could mend. But so she was. And that also, of course, is something that affects you for life as well, because you're living all the time with the feeling that, you know, that this might pass. And, you know, I think that leaves you with a serious frame of mind, not one that doesn't enjoy life. I enjoy life to the full, but also it's shot through by a knowledge of the passing of things as well.
Okay, well, let's take the first piece of music. I think this is a Micheál piece, is it? The Duke Ellington?
Well, there's a reason for this, because Micheál had given me a present of a set of Duke Ellington records. And I must say, I was very impressed with them. They're very fine jazz pieces.
You like them a lot, don't you, Micheál? Which is why you've chosen it.
I do. But I love jazz. Jazz has been something that is right through all my work, because it seems to me the perfect image for our lives. You know, we're given, you know, our lives begin and they end. It's very ordinary in one sense. But oh dear my gosh, what wonderful variations we can play on that life. And it's up to us to play those and to play them with other people, because jazz is also the social thing. And a further thing which really appeals to me is that it actually is gaiety born out of suffering, the slave trade. But out of that comes this extraordinary gaiety. It's almost like the way the Eastern European Jews came up with klezmer, or Famine Ireland comes up with the rambunctious ceilidh music. You know. But again, there's something in it which is shot through by both a sadness and a joy together.
The Tipsy Jam Blues there from Duke Ellington. Great lively piece of music there.
Yeah,
so, Saoirse, since you are a famous composer of classical music, can you appreciate other music like that? Yes.
Oh, yes.
Do you like all music?
I have a fairly wide range of sympathy. While I'm interested in jazz from time to time and do listen, I'm not really knowledgeable about it, and I've never actually used any real jazz material in my work. You know, my own path has gone differently. You know, I worked with a lot of different forms of what one might loosely call modern music, you know, right up to the avant-garde. And then on the other hand, I've also written a number of works which have elements of traditional Irish music adapted into them, you know.
Because you went to school through Irish, didn't you?
I did, yes.
But you spoke English at home.
We spoke English at home. In fact, my father, I don't know if he knew any Irish at all, and my mother might have known a little bit, you know.
And you went to UCD, did you?
I went to UCD, and by that time, my father had become reconciled to the fact that I was going to do something in music, you know.
And at what stage in UCD did you realise you could in fact make your living from being a composer?
Well, if you're talking financially, I haven't entirely made my living as a composer, because I've taught a lot as well, you know. For many years I taught in UCD. But I started to compose quite early. I think it was about 13 or so.
Really?
When I wrote some piano pieces, which are lying somewhere in the attic in a chest.
Wow.
And where they will be left forever.
Have you ever looked back at them?
Not in many, many years. But, you know, it'd be all slightly embarrassing.
No, not if you're 13. But obviously it's unusual as well for a 13-year-old boy to realise he can write music.
Well, it was just that I simply decided one day, I'll start this. And it kind of worked in its own way. You know, I didn't have enough musical background in composition to be able to sort of find out how one did it. But one of the things that was a great help at those times, and it's easy to forget it now, is that in the old hall in Exchequer Street, the Phoenix Hall, there were two free concerts a week by the symphony orchestra. A lot of the conductors were from different parts of the world, a number from Sweden and Germany, of course, and France. And some of them were very, very good. And they also had an interest, usually in the contemporary music of their own country. So you did hear a lot more than you might think, you know. In some ways, almost more than you would now. But the big advantage now, of course, is that recordings are readily available of all sorts of things.
And as a young boy, who influenced you a lot in terms of, like, did you love Mozart or did you love Debussy? I mean, were there certain influences?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it would be an influence, but certainly my preferences, probably at the peak of it all, would be Mozart. And, you know, I was fascinated just by the sound and by the manner in which he could work, be sad and joyful at literally the same, in the same phrase, you know, which I find quite a remarkable achievement.
It's absolutely heavenly, but I said we're in a very big club, you know.
Yeah, oh, sure.
I think, wasn't it Einstein who said the first person he wanted to meet in heaven was Mozart?
Yeah.
And
from your point of view, Micheál, when did you realise you could write poetry?
Whatever sort of temperament I had, something had to come out. As I said, the sense of joy, the sense of passingness, all those things had to come out. And though I loved music, I started music too late, and I knew that that was not the way I would express myself. I suppose I come from a tradition where words were very important, and therefore it came out that way. I just had to express something. That's how it started, and I suppose it becomes your life. And as I said, nothing ever matched up to that thrill. For me.
How do you go about writing a poem? Like, do you even now today, Micheál, have kind of a strict structure to your day?
I'm a great respecter of the muse, and I'm always afraid that if I if she shows up and I'm not there, she might take a terrible huff. So I try to be there for her when she comes. I get up and get dressed up and to be able to greet her. Sometimes I have to tickle her, but other times she overcomes me. And so, but whatever way it comes, that's the way it comes. But I'm only happy when it's being done. You're always thinking, when I finish this, it'll be so wonderful. I'll have this off my chest. But then, as a friend of mine used to say, it's always, I've had this meal. Where's the next one coming from? It's endless. You keep over and over again wanting to express something, and you always fall that little bit short of it and try again.
Does it get easier as years go on?
I think you build up a certain amount of experience, but each book as I've moved along has got more ambitious in terms of theme. I think I was happier with smaller structures when I was younger, but each one seems to get bigger and certainly deeper, I hope.
Will you read something from Tongues, your latest book?
I'd be delighted to do that. I mean, Tongues is essentially a celebration of the diversity of the human imagination. As a young man, I remember when I'd land in an airport like Heathrow or in Schiphol in Amsterdam or Kastrup in Denmark, these big hubs, and I would walk up and down just to hear all these people talking these extraordinary languages. And I would say to myself, here are people enjoying and suffering and going through all the human things which we all go through, and I'd say, but I can't understand what's going on inside in their heads. Is it the same thing? And then it suddenly occurred to me, that in a sense, deep down in the human heart, most of the emotions, people go through the same things. They fall in love. They have lovers. They lose. And so forth. But you have to respect the variety. You have to respect the diversity in order to get to that central thing. And suddenly I read in the paper then a couple of years ago, at the height of the boom, that I think it was 208 languages were being spoken in Ireland. And I thought, let's celebrate that wonderful diversity. Just take Proverbs, for example. How somebody will say, too many cooks spoil the broth in English. But the Russians then say, seven nurses and the child is without an eye. And the Japanese say, when the skippers increase, the ship goes up the mountain. Which is an extraordinarily surreal image,
Is it true you speak about 12 languages, Micheál?
It's untrue. I've kept up probably, in a good week I'd speak five or six. Thanks to Skype, I talk to my friends all the time. I can work up another few in the environment and so on, but Skype is wonderful. My idea of a relaxing evening is to talk to friends on
Skype. In different languages?
Yeah, to friends that I've made in different cultures and so on, because it's about relationships more than anything else. Which brings me to this partings, which, there's always a sense, that we three, even here, would probably never sit at this spot again. And we're enjoying the conversation, but we know it's also thing. So there's a meeting and a parting. The Italians and the French say to part is to die a little. And the Danes will say that we meet and part is life's way, and that we part and meet is life's song. But my favourite one is the Chinese one, and I want to just give you that one and then read a short poem meditating on that one. The Chinese one is, when meeting, happy laughter, when parting, grief. The deeper the delight at every re-meeting, the deeper the transience running parallel. Our leaving proportionate to our greeting, Heywood's maxim, such welcome, such farewell. Hours of catching up, the days of fun, relearning each other's commonplace, flutter tongue of things done and undone, our kitchen conversation face to face. And all those things we say we'll have to do, half knowing how slyly time tiptoes already gone, while we were only starting, but also more aware in every adieu, how in the light of ending, friendship grows, laughter echoes, even in the grief of parting.
That's beautiful.
Yes,
very interesting.
Thank you.
When you go about writing a piece of music, Saoirse, take me through how you do that. I mean, do you have to imagine how it's going to sound when it's played by the orchestra? I mean, how do you go about writing?
Well, to an extent you do, of course, but that'll be when you get to the stage of even orchestrating it. But essentially, I think all artistic creative work is just, it's like having a dialogue with yourself, It's very difficult. So what has always been important to me was to, you try something and you leave it for a day and you come back again and you know then, does this work? Has it potential or not? It's like writing a letter. You write a sentence or two, and then gradually that leads to a bit more, if you follow what I mean. Or it doesn't. You might rub it out the next day.
Because it's interesting. You're both interested in both words and music. Yeah. When did you both first collaborate together, Micheál? And is he difficult to work with now, the Shore Show? Tell me.
No, I've worked with a fair number of composers. But Shore Show is, whatever our personalities are, we understand one another.
Because sure. You're quite different people, even just listening and watching you now, course, which yes. I can see, yeah. You know, yeah. Does work sometimes.
Yeah, that's
opposites
right.
attract.
Oh, he's the one with the beard.
Well, you know, as I said earlier on, you know, Shorsha loves words.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And I love music, so I mean, that's a great start. Also, I think temperamentally, we're fairly, you can see that probably looking at it, we're quite different. Shorsha is probably less intense than I am. I have a fairly intense personality. That's the way I'm made. Shorsha's much more more placid. Yeah, yeah, more placid, which is great for him. Great when you see him, I mean, pulling everything together when you've got to play and everything. Yeah. But musicians tend to be, I think, good people to work with in general, because what you've got to remember is that painters work on their own, poets work on their own, yeah. But musicians have to work with other people.
That's absolutely
you know, and they have to get on with other people. I've got to say, and let me say it publicly, that you know, it's been a great pleasure always to work with Shorsha.
And is that mutual, Shorsha?
Oh, yes.
you better say that.
Absolutely. Because I have worked with different poets from time to time, and the two works involving Micheál.
One was Naked Flame, and the other is Earlsford Suite.
That's right, yes.
Well, like, even if we take something like Earlsford Suite,
yeah.
Like how do you go about, if you decide, right, we're going to do something together, mm. how does that begin?
In all the cases where I've worked with the poet, I've always talked to them first. You know, that's the great, it's a wonderful advantage to have, so that you can say sort of what I would think.
Yeah, this is what I'm
I
thinking.
I could set, you know, or somehow to try and give an impression.
And would you have a definite idea of what you might be seeking? No.
Not necessarily.
So what do you say to them?
Sure, she gives you things beforehand too, which he laid down in all cases, which I think are very sensible. And I kind of know it for music is that, you know,
what are they?
Well, it's the old sort of thing. If you have a song, it's to have a voice, something that announces the theme, a sad verse and a joyful verse to finish with. In other words, Shorsha says to me, don't give me all the one mood. Yeah. Give me different moods to set. But he laid all that down beforehand in case he's forgotten.
Yeah, well, I think also too, what suits me about that type of poem as well is the fact that I work most of the time in some way or other with irregular shapes rather than regular shapes. And that fits very well.
What do you mean by that now, for people who aren't music experts?
Yeah, that's right. I wish I could say it more clearly. Very often, without having a theme, you start with an idea, which is then contrasted with another block, and another block, all of different shapes and sizes. And that is, in a way, what almost suggested by that poem, you know?
And to try and illustrate what we are talking about, Micheál, what's that you have in front of you? Is that Earlsford Suite or Naked Flame?
Earlsford Suite. I mean, it was actually, it was a commission that we got through Duches, is the
That's
people
right,
was.
Duches.
And they were doing various buildings and they wanted different types of music. And they chose the concert hall as the classical one and it was to be performed there. And they said, we want a poem. It's one of those things, commissions are those things when you're asked on the phone, would you like to do it? And you say, yes, I'd love to. That'd be wonderful. I will. And you put down the phone and you say, what have I done?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
what have I really let myself in for? You know, but when I sat down and thought about it, it was an Earlsford Terrace, and it fitted perfectly for me because, first of all, I was born on Earlsford Terrace. I was born in the Stella Morris nursing home, which was the place for middle class boys to be born in, under the nurses Gaffney, mother and daughter, who ran the establishment in 47, the year of the Great Snow. And so I said, now that's it. And then I thought too, though I'm a Trinity man, I was at Trinity, I had done a trick in that extraordinary hall, that exam hall in UCD, which became the concert hall. So I said, now there's another one. And of course, finally, I had a work premiered with Shorsha in the concert. So it was wonderful. I had three pieces to it. So I did, let me just read the first one, which is Delivery, which of course is a reference reference to arriving. This is my street. Here I come wandering in. The Stella Morris home, a stone's throw from a park entrance where bronze fates spin as 1947 is gathering snow. A Bedouin boy stumbles on Dead Sea Scrolls, the year of carbon dating and heckless fire, of new look hemlines and platform soles, Prokofiev's sixth, a streetcar named Desire. Maybe I can't, and still I fancy I recall just a busy pavement at the corner of a town where a woman tucks me in the mood and tone of a year that sinks and carbons into my bone as a lava of pure desire comes scrolling down and skies of January snow begin to fall.
And when you get those words, Saoirse, yeah, how did you go then about writing the music?
One of the things you can do, and which I certainly did there, was to make a sort of musical construction and follow certain constructional principles of it. But I liked the poem a great deal because it has wonderful imagery, which is very, very immediate. For instance, things like references to platform souls.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember when they first came out, you know.
They're all back now.
I know they're back. They've been back several times since, but there you are. And a lot of the imagery is caught there in almost a list, though not quite a list, of bits and pieces, so it appears. But it all hangs together, you know. And so I constructed a piece that hangs, I hope, together.
In Earth for its Sweet, in this piece of music,
yeah,
what would have influenced you? What type of music?
It's influenced by what is more or less a tonal musical construction. It's like it descends and wriggles around in thirds a lot in the vocal part, and that influences all the music in it.
Let's have a little listen now to one of your collaborations, Earth for its Sweet, number one. The Earth for its Sweet, number one there, a collaboration between Micheál and Saoirse, sung beautifully there by Sylvia O'Brien, and that was courtesy of the Contemporary Music Centre. Just before we go to the break, it must be extraordinary to sit here and listen to that beautiful piece of work and know you wrote it, both of you.
Well,
I'd die happy if I'd written that.
It is kind of nice.
Yeah.
All right, but I mean, look, yeah, I've just been looking there again, Micheál O'Shiel's new book, Tongues.
Yeah.
This really has taken my fancy very much. And I may say, just in passing, that I'm delighted to see that the very first poem refers to a place I'm very fond of, and that is Réoengi. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Micheál, but it's one of the Zen gardens in Kyoto. And I went there in 2002, and I remember it so well. It was such a wonderful experience, in spite of the fact that the language is, I don't have Micheál's
ability to speak Japanese.
But it was so interesting to be there, and it was just wonderful to go around the Zen gardens of Kyoto. It was just a major experience.
Why? Just feels
because
extraordinary.
I've had a long interest in things Japanese. I mean, I can't compete with Micheál here, who speaks the language fluently. But I had such a good time there. Every time I stopped at a railway station, you know, thinking of where I needed to go, and looking at this mass of kanji facing me, and always some man would come up to me and say ha ha and point at the screen, and I'd say Ikebukuro, that's where I was living, And he'd say, ha, ikebukuro. And then he would go play all the thing, like rather like a cinema org, you know, and eventually the ticket would come out and he'd hand it to me with a little bow. I thought, well, they're so nice. This happened again and again, you know.
Wow. Why do you both love Japan so much? How come you can speak Japanese, Michal?
It's one of my great, it's a great privilege of mine, really. In my 50s, I was translated, I think four of my books have come out in Japanese. And so I was invited to read there. And I have this awful thing. I can't bear going to cultures where I'm a tourist. I want to be a visitor. And so I just said, that's it. I've got to learn Japanese. So I did. But I mean, gosh, what a gift Skype is. You know, I talk to a friend every day in Kyoto in Japanese on Skype. And I can see a Buddha altar in the background and everything. It's absolutely wonderful.
They say,
absolutely
I really, wonderful. Really respect yes. and admire yes. Shorsha Bodley in Japanese. Say it. I want to hear it.
Shorsha Bodley-san wa daisuki mo san shorsha demasu.
I really like that. Michal, lots of your poetry, I'm not saying it's autobiographical, but you're very open about your emotions and you write about love a lot.
I've always felt that the way you make friends, the way you indeed fall in love, is by showing vulnerability. So many people want to hide that. And I've always found that, you know, lovers alone, lovers protect, to quote Patrick Kavanagh, you know, that it's by being vulnerable. So I'm afraid I've always, and I don't apologise, I've always been, made myself vulnerable in what I write, because I think that's what people are wanting to hear. I think they want, I don't mean in a confessional way or self-indulgent way, but in a way in which I hope expresses other people, for other people as well, not just for myself. And you asked me about love. I've had 40 years with the most wonderful woman I could ever have imagined meeting. It's so easy to want to praise and give thanks for that. I live in a loving environment. It's something to celebrate, but it's also in the knowledge. I mean, people can think that's very, you know, it's very easy. You know, I always, when I talk of love poems, I'm aware that there's a lot of brokenness. I know there's a lot of loneliness. I have friends who have lost their partners. And so I'm terribly conscious of that.
But what's lovely when you write about Breed, who's your wife you're talking about, is you're not just celebrating, say, the excitement of the first few, I don't know, months of meeting. Like, you celebrate almost the love that you've had over the decades.
Well, in the book I wrote, Love Life, you know, it was an attempt to go through the whole, from the first absolute walking in air and falling in love, which everybody must go through, but to facing, because, and I say this in the knowledge when people think maybe, you know, you've been so blessed, you've been so lucky, easy to talk about that. But in fact, of course, Breed suffers from Parkinson's disease and has had some, you know, for many years hasn't been well. But actually, that's part of the richness of having been with somebody all your life, and you face these things together is an extraordinary enrichment.
Has that impacted enormously on both Breed's life and your own?
Well, in so far as it has, you know, we loved going to the theatre together, and she finds now to sit at the theatre for is too much for her. She can't get up, and it's difficult. So it's very tough. She's had a very tough time with it, but she's the same wonderful Breed, the same spirit, we live with that together.
And she's lucky she's had all these beautiful love poems.
Well, she deserves them all.
And you're married to a musicologist now, aren't you,
Shorsha? That's right, yes.
Do you get her to listen to some of your compositions for what she thinks as a musicologist? What is a musicologist?
A very good question.
Sounds good.
Well, own up.
it's someone, I suppose, who's has a knowledge of music rather than being an actual performer or a composer.
Do you have music playing all day? Like,
no, please. No, that I leave that to places where music is
excellent
is performed.
And you have children from a previous marriage, and your first wife is dead.
Right.
And do they get any of your musical genes?
I think they suffered a bit. My first kids, anyway, and possibly even my second lot as well. The first lot certainly suffered from the fact that at school they said, oh, yes, your father, Shorsha Bodley, yeah, well, you must be very good at music, as which they would inwardly cringe.
Yeah.
And so they didn't actually go into that.
They probably reacted against it almost.
Well, no, but just I don't think they reacted against it, but they just didn't want to follow it up. Though my son, who lives in London, does play the mandolin.
You go full circle.
Yes, indeed.
His grandfather.
And plays, play, yeah, indeed, my his grandfather's instrument. So there you are.
Goes full circle. And you had one little boy, didn't you, who died tragically?
That's right, yes. Well, he had Patau's syndrome, which is a syndrome that's not really compatible with life. You one can't say why it happens. Nobody knows, I think, really, you know. But he lasted only 1 month, you know. And I think that was the hardest time of my life, you know, to have to deal with that. It's very, very difficult.
What was his name?
Dara. And, you know, it was just something we had to deal with. And you get through it all right. And I can remember him very, very clearly. And, you know, from him I learned the sheer strength and the ferocity of the human will to live, you know. Because it was quite like when he was dying, it was like that, you know, he would drop and you think he's gone. The next minute he'd be back up again, you know.
Yeah,
so it was really hard.
Did you find music a comfort at some time like that?
Not so much, but I can tell you what was an enormous comfort, and that was the nursing in the special baby unit down in Hollis Street.
Oh,
they were fantastic.
Unit 8, actually.
Yeah. They were just fantastic, you know. I mean, it was like having hands hold you up.
Yeah. Did it change you? And people, I know you said it was the most difficult part of your life.
I don't know whether you could say. It's just part of your life. And it's like the various things that happen. You integrate them into you. You know, you can't pretend they didn't happen, you know. And you are sort of grieving after a death. You just have to go through it, you know. And that's really it. But I mean, naturally, of course, that's become a part of me very, very clearly.
It's probably like you were talking about earlier, Micheál, maybe about your polio or your mother being ill. That, I suppose there are experiences that form you, but that change you in a particular way.
Well, I suppose really, I mean, I spoke earlier about vulnerability. The other thing is that my whole life is a search for meaning, an attempt to understand as I go through life, the different stages, to understand all the things that have happened and to try and, in a sense, to do that for other people as well who may enjoy what I write. So that I think that goes back to having to ask the fundamental questions as a boy as to what life meant.
And do you think as you've gone through life trying to find out what the meaning of life is, that as it's progressed, you understand life more or not?
Well, I mean, I suppose I put it this way. I'm a very typical product of the 60s. I came to manhood in the 60s and I rejected everything. I rejected the sort of religion I was brought up with. It seemed authoritarian. It seemed a form of social control. I was a typical of that. But I think as the years passed and I thought more and more about it and read great poets like people like Dante and I suppose John Donne and Herbert, Milton, Hopkins, and then even our own great Patrick Kavanagh, you know, it seemed to me and also I think I thought an awful lot about science and thought about the vastness of this universe we live in. It's just going on expanding and expanding beyond all our imaginations. And as I touch this table below me, there's a subatomic world that's just is equally endless and amazing that's going on completely beyond all human comprehension. So the more that I felt about that, I sort of began to think that, you know, that it rang more and more true that there was some meaning to all of this. I do think there is deeper meaning to things.
Yeah. Do you think that, Saoirse?
Well, I'd put it differently to Micheál, but I mentioned to you this long 50-minute work.
Piece,
which is called News from Donabate, because that's where I was at the time.
Okay.
And I had a very curious experience where suddenly I was quite literally walking on air for about a fortnight, you know.
After you wrote that?
This was long before I wrote it.
Okay.
And it just had such an effect on me that I have an awareness ever since that there is a different dimension to life.
But what do you mean you felt like you were walking on air for 2 weeks?
Well, quite literally. Yes, that is part of the problem. I couldn't tell you.
I want to know how you felt about that.
It suddenly, it wasn't.
It's
it
called
wasn't.
Falling in love.
No, it wasn't actually. It was nothing like that. It was just suddenly something that came over me. And it's hard to say what.
And you used to go to Donabate on holidays, wasn't it?
No, I used to go to Donabate in the month of September for a couple of weeks because I was able to fit it in with college and do the college exams and compose at the same time.
And when did this walking on air for 2 weeks happen? Recently? Shorter?
Oh, no. This was about over 30 years ago. You know?
So you've been waiting for another moment like that ever since?
Yes.
Well, maybe it will happen soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
But look, we're going to take one last piece of music. Tell me why you've chosen it, Micheál.
Because I think Beethoven reached his absolute superb best in those final quartets.
Well, it just remains for me to thank you both very much. Micheál O'Shiel, Seosamh Bodley, it's been my absolute pleasure to have you here this morning. My thanks to my producer, Eileen Heron, on sound, Cara O'Hare. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, thank you very much for listening. And we're going to go out listening to Beethoven Quartet, Opus 135, The Last Movement.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with the Sunday Times Magazine. Thought-provoking, visually arresting, and oh so entertaining. Guard your copy fiercely.